And let's go next to the American heartland, where a hospital administrator is trying a different approach to a chronic problem. The problem is recruiting doctors to rural America. For certain doctors, a posting in a small town is just not attractive to them. If they're not from there, they may even see it as a hardship. So a tiny hospital in southwest Kansas is targeting people who seem to be attracted to a challenge. This is called mission-focused medicine, which means attracting the same kinds of doctors who are drawn to service in third world countries. From Harvest Public Media, Peggy Lowe explains.
It's not easy getting to Ashland, Kansas, population 855. After the five-hour drive south from Kansas City, you land in one of the last outposts on the Kansas Open Range, where buffalo still really roam along the rolling, dusty plains. There's no gas station here, unless you count the pump at the farmer's co-op that uses dial-up for credit card approval. The nearest Starbucks? 160 miles away. The Ashland Health Clinic has 24 beds, but if there's no doctor there, the next closest is 50 miles north in Dodge City. Yeah, that's the same one from those old cowboy movies. So when Benjamin Anderson interviewed for the clinic's CEO job in 2009, he says the board chairman was exceedingly blunt.
Ben, our facilities are 55 years old. Our finances are challenged. Our morale is low. Turnover's up. We've been out without an administrator for 6 months. We've been out without a doctor for 7 or 8 months. We really need this facility in this community. And if we don't have this facility, we'll lose our school. And if we don't have our hospital and our school, this will become a ghost town very quickly.
That pitch clicked for Anderson. He gave up his physician recruiter job in Dallas and moved with his wife out here to become Ashland's new CEO.
I've always had to have a job that matters. I have to have a position where I know it's not just a paycheck.
Hello, Benjamin.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Anderson is now well known on Ashland's Main Street. But he knew he needed doctors for the hospital to succeed, and he knew he had to offer something different than the thousands of small towns he was competing with. So he came up with a novel plan. He offers potential candidates 8 weeks off to do missionary work overseas, because he's found that a doctor who is willing to sleep on a cot in the Amazon or treat earthquake victims in Haiti is ready to serve in rural Kansas. Anderson calls it mission-focused medicine.
When you recruit a mission-focused provider, they want to see the ghettos. They want to know that there's no Spanish-speaking provider in more than a one-hour drive. They want to see houses that are falling down, widows that are uncared for. They want to know that there's need and that by them coming there, they would fill a disparity that would otherwise not be filled. And so we reversed it.
It worked. Last July, Dr. Dan Schumann and his family moved here from the Austin, Texas area. The difference between here and all the other needy areas was his ability to continue his missionary work in Haiti and Mexico during his 8 weeks off. But Dr. Schumann says Ashland's own challenges were equally attractive.
When your primary focus is sort of a mission-based focus, when you get into things in order to try to relieve suffering or work towards eliminating disparities, then you want to know about those things, and it's appealing to see opportunities.
Staff meeting in the dining room at 2 o'clock, and all staff meeting in the dining room at 2 o'clock.
Studies suggest that finding primary care providers in rural areas is at crisis levels. More medical students are specializing, so general practitioners are very hard to find. And those who can deal with the lower pay and isolation in rural areas, even harder. So Anderson raised the bar by shooting for a higher cause. At every staff meeting, he's part cheerleader, part chaplain.
So together, let's read the mission statement. Entrusted with people's lives, we are committed to provide, enhance, and preserve the health care of our community with compassion, dignity, and excellence. All right, that was all right first round. Let's try that again.
Things are looking up for Ashland. In addition to Dr. Schumann, Anderson has recruited a nursing director. And that doc who slept on the cot in the Amazon, she was recently in Ashland for interviews. For NPR News, I'm Peggy Lowe.
President Obama filled in some details today about his latest effort to shore up the housing market. The plan is designed to make it easier for homeowners to refinance and take advantage of rock-bottom interest rates. But whether it will work or even get past Congress is another matter. As NPR's Scott Horsley reports, earlier White House efforts to fix the housing market have fallen far short of expectations.
Interest rates on home loans have been at historic lows, under 4%.
But millions of Americans haven't gotten the benefit because they're locked into a more expensive mortgage and haven't been able to refinance because their home's lost value or their credit's damaged or because their lender simply doesn't want to. President Obama's proposal would make it easier for anyone who's current on their existing loan to get a new, cheaper mortgage through the Federal Housing Administration.
What this plan will do is help millions of responsible homeowners who make their payments on time but find themselves trapped under falling home values or wrapped up in red tape.
Previous White House refinancing efforts have covered only borrowers with government-guaranteed loans. Now, Mr. Obama wants to extend the opportunity to all borrowers.
No more red tape. No more runaround from the banks. And a small fee on the largest financial institutions will make sure it doesn't add to our deficit.
But the administration's refinancing efforts so far have been a disappointment. Nearly a million borrowers have gotten cheaper loans, but economists say that's a small fraction of the number who could benefit. Mr. Obama acknowledged today his plan has not worked as quickly or as well as he hoped. White House advisor Gene Sperling says the administration's trying to tweak the program so lenders are more motivated to compete for the refinancing business.
Right now, a bank that is holding your mortgage at 7% does not have a lot of incentive to go to responsible homeowners making their payment and say, hey, would you like to refinance at 4%? But once they believe that that mortgage could be stolen away from them by a competitor offering a better rate, then they get in line and want to get there first.
Mike Calhoun, who's with the Center for Responsible Lending, says there's widespread agreement the housing market needs more help. While there's no silver bullet, Calhoun says, the White House proposal is a good start.
I think the administration has recognized they had not done enough on housing, and I think this is part of their renewed effort to move the housing market through to recovery, both for the housing market and for the overall economy.
But it's far from clear that Congress will go along with the president's proposal, especially the bank tax he suggested to cover the cost, estimated at $5 to $10 billion. The White House has been advocating a similar tax for 2 years now with no success. Today's announcement seems at least partly designed to showcase the president making an effort in the housing arena, whether or not Congress follows his lead.
Government certainly can't fix the entire problem on its own. But it is wrong for anybody to suggest that the only option for struggling responsible homeowners is to sit and wait for the housing market to hit bottom.
That's precisely the suggestion that Mitt Romney made to a Nevada newspaper last fall. Romney has since appeared to soften his stance, saying efforts to promote refinancing are at least worth further consideration. Meanwhile, the administration is taking some steps on its own. The president's new consumer advocate is drafting simplified loan documents to help borrowers make an informed choice. Mr. Obama confessed to being puzzled himself by unintelligible banking paperwork.
I remember when Michelle and I bought our first condo. And we're both lawyers.
The administration is also working to help investors buy foreclosed homes and convert them to rental properties. That could prevent a glut of vacant houses that drive down values in a whole neighborhood. Scott Horsley, NPR News, The White House.
50 years ago today, a novel appeared that made its author a literary celebrity. It also inspired a movie that won the Best Picture Oscar and helped change the way we think about mental health institutions. Ken Kesey's debut novel, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, has become an American classic. From New York, Tom Vitale has this appreciation.
In 1992, Ken Kesey told me the novel he admired most was Herman Melville's Moby Dick.
Moby Dick deals with what I call the American terror. It's a thing that's out there ahead of us in the new frontier, the particular thing that is really frightening to us that we avoid until finally you've got an Ahab who goes out there and takes it on, for good or evil, he takes it on.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is about the terror of a group of mental patients at the mercy of an evil hospital administration. Their Ahab is Randall Patrick McMurphy. Their Queequeg is the narrator, Chief Bromden, a 6'8" Native American and a longtime patient at the Oregon Asylum. The novel opens with the chief contemplating his fear of the orderlies.
They're out there, black boys in white suits up before me to commit sex acts in the hall and get it mopped up before I can catch them.
The reading is by Kesey scholar Robert Fagan.
I creep along the wall, quiet as dust, in my canvas shoes. but they got special sensitive equipment, detects my fear, and they all look up, all three at once, eyes glittering out of the black faces like the hard glitter of radio tubes out of the back of an old radio.
Ken Kesey wrote this opening passage of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest while he was high on peyote, working as a nurse's aide in the psychiatric ward of the Menlo Park Veterans Hospital. It was 1960. He was a 25-year-old creative writing student at Stanford University who had also volunteered for CIA-financed experiments with hallucinogens at the same hospital.
They gave these right on the ward in a little room where you could look out and see everybody on the ward.
Faye Kesey McMurtry was pregnant with the couple's first child while her husband was working on the overnight shift.
And as he would look out the window, he began to wonder, you know, what's the difference between the orderlies and the nurse and the patients? And he began to see that they were all damaged in some way or another.
In Cuckoo's Nest, most of those characters were people on the ward where I was working. The only character that really wasn't there was McMurphy and, of course, the Indian. But this was the character that they all wanted, and you could feel their desire for this John Wayne American character.
Kesey's John Wayne is a brawling, swearing, poker-hustling Korean War hero who fakes insanity at a prison work farm in order to be transferred to what he thinks is an easier time at the psychiatric hospital. When Randall Patrick McMurphy gets there, he begins an epic battle for freedom from the iron fist of Nurse Ratched, who runs the ward. In the film adaptation, Louise Fletcher plays the nurse, Jack Nicholson plays McMurphy.
What I'd like to suggest is that we change the work detail tonight so that we can watch the ball game.
Well, Mr. McMurphy, what you're asking is that we change a very carefully worked out schedule.
A little change never hurt, huh? A little variety.
Conformity was a pressing issue in the America of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Robert Fagan is writing a biography of Ken Kesey.
And the failure to conform was looked at as a deviation and therefore dangerous.
In the story, McMurphy is punished for challenging authority. First, he's crucified with electroshock therapy, and then martyred with a lobotomy. When he was researching the novel, Kesey volunteered to undergo shock therapy in a secret session at the hospital.
They was giving me 10,000 watts a day, you know, and I'm hot to trot. Next woman takes me on is going to light up like a pinball machine and pay off in silver dollars.
The 1975 film of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest swept the major Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Actor, Actress, Director, and Screenplay. But Kesey wasn't happy with Hollywood's version. His own screenplay had been rejected.
I really wrote it to be as weird as I thought being in the Nut House was, but it wasn't what they wanted. I was naive at the time. I wanted to do Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and they wanted to do Hogan's Heroes.
The main difference between the film and the novel is that the film is missing the chief's disturbing point of view of the forces in society pressuring individuals to conform, a conspiracy he calls the Combine. Robert Fagan says that perspective is what makes the story a fable for every time.
It's this larger structure of conflict between freedom and authority, and done in a way that recognizes the power of that story, not only in our culture, but in almost any culture, that has kept the story itself so fresh.
Ken Kesey followed One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with another masterpiece 2 years later, Sometimes a Great Notion. He continued to write for the rest of his life, but he said he was always writing the same story.
It's the only story I got. I just want to have to keep changing locales and times and characters because you have to keep disguising the story, and it's essentially that the small can overcome the large with treachery and creativity and humor.
Ken Kesey died in 2001 after surgery to remove a tumor from his liver. He was 66 years old. He said he never saw the film version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
This is NPR News.
And the voice of one company will be changing soon. Sony has announced it's getting a new CEO. The Welsh-born Howard Stringer, Sony's first non-Japanese leader, will be replaced by the Japanese-born Kazuro Hirai. Hirai is the head of consumer products, but more importantly, worked his way up through the video game division. Stringer has long urged the company to have Hirai succeed him. Sony is struggling with falling sales, especially in its TV division, and a rising yen. And that was apparently today after it was apparent today after it reported its latest earnings. Sony saw a net loss of more than $2 billion in its third quarter. The new CEO has quite a to-do list, and that's the Business News on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Blogg. Time now for another home video recommendation from our movie critic, Bob Mondello. With the silent film The Artist in competition for this year's Best Picture Oscar, Bob's been thinking a lot lately about the pre-talkie era. Then, just a few days ago, a new old movie crossed his desk. The last silent film to win for Best Picture has just been released on Blu-ray. It's the 1927 flying ace epic, Wings.
World War I biplanes dive through clouds high above a battlefield. Dogfights in the air, bombs on the ground, and all of it without special effects. Wings is an old-school epic, enormous in scope and basically real. The U.S. Army provided 220 planes, several thousand soldiers, and all sorts of logistical help. There's a story, and it's a rouser. Two doughboys go off to war, both in love with the same girl. Rivals at first, they become friends, but then, well, more you're not going to get from me. Suffice it to say that there's a reason Wings won the first ever Best Picture Oscar. That was the year the jazz singer brought sound to film, so Wings had to be bigger, better, and louder, too. In big cities, it was accompanied by a full orchestra with sound effects guys in the theater to provide the roar of planes and bullets. To recreate that for the Blu-ray restoration, the filmmakers went back to the original shooting script and musical score, so they knew exactly where the sound effects should be, where the orchestra should burst into Mendelssohn for flight scenes, and where the director wanted hand-painted yellow flames leaping from cockpits as planes went down. In an age of black-and-white silent film, those flames must have been astonishing. When director William Wellman started working on Wings, Hollywood hadn't yet figured out how to film an air war story. Most World War I planes, remember, were almost like kites made of canvas and baling wire, and were way too small to hold a cameraman and a pilot and an actor. So Wellman bolted cameras directly to the planes and gave his 20-something stars flying lessons. In the making of extras, Wellman's son remembers that leading man Charles Buddy Rogers had never been in a plane in his life.
They would go up in a two-seat plane, and there would be a safety pilot who would duck down, and then the actors flew the plane. But you have to fly those planes. If you know, you've got a control stick here, you got to work it to keep it in the air. Yep. Buddy Rogers, my father said, he spent something like 98 hours in the air. When he would come down after shooting for a while, he would throw up.
Who could blame him? But the results are spectacular. Flying footage that makes the green screen trickery of modern films look downright lame. Wings has some down-to-earth pleasures, too. Gary Cooper in the bit part that kicked off his career, and Clara Bow, the It Girl, lighting up the screen silently. No wonder so many in the film industry despaired when big, clunky sound cameras came in, forcing everyone to stand in one place and talk into microphones. Spectacle and daredeviltry wouldn't make a comeback for years. But this one last time, Wings sure sent them soaring. I'm Bob Mondello.